Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The images are heartbreaking. Political wives standing stoically in the spotlight with husbands who have betrayed them. It's become a kind of national ritual, but not for Jenny Sanford. Last June, when her husband, South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, made his teary-eyed, televised mea culpa, he faced the press alone.
I've been unfaithful to my wife. I developed a relationship with which started as a dear friend from Argentina.
A dear friend, a woman, the other woman, who he would later go on to say was the love of his life.
I will be able to die knowing that I had met my soulmate. This was a whole lot more than a simple affair, but it's a love story.
Imagine watching that, hearing that as the wife with four young children and dreams in shatters. But this was not a wretched, wronged wife story. As the governor unraveled, Jenny Sanford stood tall and became, for many, a kind of role model. Now she's telling the story, the whole story, from her side, this hour on Point, South Carolina First Lady Jenny Sanford, on living through betrayal and standing up again. You can join the conversation. What did you think as you watched this story from the outside? What do you say today to Jenny Sanford? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Jenny Sanford. Her new memoir is Staying True. It's honest, it's painful, it is, in its way, uplifting. Jenny Sanford, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thanks very much for being here. And you're talking nonstop about this these days. Is it like living in a kind of flashback, Ms. Sanford?
To some extent it is, yes. But, you know, because it's so public and Mark's the one that made it public, I suspect it's going to be spoken about for the rest of my life to some extent. I look forward to when it's not a common topic.
Right. I'm sure you do. But right now you're out there, and you're out there with a lot of detail about the most difficult days of this marriage and about the whole arc of this marriage. You've called it cathartic. It must be overwhelming sometimes, though, to go through it again and again. We're grateful to you for being here.
Yes. Yes.
It seemed important to you to get this story out. Why?
You know, life throws you curveballs sometimes, and this situation is not certainly anything I ever anticipated, you know, what happened this summer and what happened to my marriage. But it became public because of the way the decisions Mark made, I guess. And, you know, so it, as I tell my boys, it is now part of who we are. And it is public. It's not something I'd like to have made public, your personal life. Mm. But given that it's already there, I might as well try to turn it to a positive. So if my story can help empower other women to stand tall when life throws them some curveballs too, whether it's infidelity or some other problem in their life, I will feel like I had done something good out of this.
Are you telling this story in part for other political wives, for other Elizabeth Edwards or Silda Spitzers or future political wives?
You know, I don't know that it's specific to political wives or, you know, just any wife or any woman that finds herself in an unhappy situation or a challenging situation or one where somebody else's poor choices impact you. It's more the story of how do you stay focused on your values and who you are and not let somebody else's poor choices somehow degrade you or shame you or make you feel something you shouldn't feel. You should feel hurt. I am hurt by what's happened, but it doesn't change who I am, and how I deal with it is important going forward. In other words, you know, lots of us face challenges in life. And lots of us, you know, people make mistakes. It's how you grow from the challenges on your plate and what you learn from them and how you deal with them that sometimes tells us a lot about who we are.
I wish you'd
As for political wives,
yes.
It is obviously there's some stuff in the book that is relevant for political wives or spouses of people who hold big jobs, I guess. You know, it's very easy in some of those jobs. You know, you deal with a lot of pressures, a lot of stresses, number one, the demands on your time, but also the constant need to cultivate an image in, you know, for our politicians mm-hmm. creates a whole host of challenges. And it makes it easy sometimes for the politicians to become what I call disconnected. And so there, I think the lessons in the book for political wives are more along that line than, you know, should you stand by your husband or should you not? I think that's a personal choice that has to be made and weighed very carefully based on your own personal and unique situation.
Clearly, your husband, Mark Sanford, Governor Mark Sanford, was very disconnected by the time this all came apart. And you tell the story very, very movingly. It's somewhat surprising to me. There's also plenty of kind of humor in here. Even as this happened, I wish you'd take us back to that summer day last year, June 24th, 2009, when everything tumbled out into public. And I was struck just off the bat by some of the... You had a lot of girlfriends gathered around you at your house on Sullivan Island. Your sister Kathy was there. And there was a... I mean, it was a horrible day. You make no bones about that. But there was also a kind of, strong humor in the air. Your sister Kathy, you know, sort of hooting, saying he wasn't hiking the Appalachian Trail. He was getting Argentine tail. Even there was a kind of high spirit in response to a tough day, Jenny Sanford.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the lesson there is make sure you got good girlfriends and good sisters and people who will help you through those challenging times. It does make a difference. You know, a little laughter goes a long way.
Take us back to that day on June 24th, 2009. What did you know that the rest of the world did not about what we would all soon begin to learn about?
Well, I already knew on the day he made that press conference, I had known for 6 months then that he had been having an affair. I had also learned over the months that it was an affair he was having a hard time giving up. So he clearly had feelings for this other woman. But I had told him, and he had told me, that it was important for us to work to repair the marriage and to make it stronger. And so when he came back that day, all I knew was that he had not acted as I had expected or wanted or hoped. He had, in fact, gone against my wishes and gone to see this woman. And I did not stand by him. But I knew that he was going to be revealing some painful things in that press conference.
You had, as you write, been quietly separated for a couple of weeks at that point. You didn't know exactly where he was. But before he took off to get his head right, you quote him, or he'd explain to your sons, you say, he looked me straight in the eye and said, I will not see her. That was a lie.
That's correct. It turned out to be, yes, a lie.
And when he got back to the airport in Atlanta and spoke with you, he said the good news is it's over. Was that a lie as well?
You know, I don't know whether it was a lie. Clearly, we found out later that day in that press conference, he still had feelings for her, too. So, you know, I don't know whether whether the relationship was, in fact, over then or not. I make a point right now of not really asking that. He was being quite deceptive.
He'd been very high profile in the countries, talked of as a potential Republican presidential candidate, was the head of the Republican Governors Association, extremely prominent, had been a big resistor of the stimulus package that the Obama administration was rolling out, even though South Carolina's got plenty of poverty there. And as he came, I mean, remind us of the whole sort of a furor over where he was. People, no one knew, and it was raised a kind of hue and cry, where is Mark Sanford? His office was saying he was on the Appalachian Trail, but nobody was sure.
Right. Now, Tom, as you pointed out, I had asked him to leave, and the idea was that that he would leave myself and our four sons for a period of 30 days at the minimum without having any contact whatsoever with us. My hope was that I would, by starving him of contact with his wife and his children, that he might wake up and see what he was about to lose if he were to go and see his mistress. And I knew for the first week he was, in fact, at his office in Columbia. Mm-hmm. But the second week, he told everybody and his staff that he was going to go hiking the Appalachian Trail. And so I heard through his staff that he was supposedly on the Appalachian Trail. But in fact, I didn't really know where he was. And I was frankly hoping he was on the Appalachian Trail. And I was hoping he was alone on the Appalachian Trail. But I came to, once I heard that he was, in fact, quote, missing, and, you know, attempts to contact him on his cell phone were going unanswered. There were some doubts about really, in fact, where he was. And those doubts in my mind started to make me think he might, in fact, be in Argentina.
He was still on his way back trying to avoid telling all, even calling you to kind of strategize about what to do. You finally told him in what you call your best political, if not spousal, advice, well, be honest and get it over with, and whatever you do, don't talk about your heart. Even that he couldn't live up to. There was a lot of talk about his heart. When he finally went on television, you're sitting there in your Sullivan Island home watching with your gal pals, and he's talking about his soulmate, not you.
Right. You know, I mean, this is clearly the it's the story of a man who was lost, and he wasn't really listening to anybody. So, no, he did not take my advice that day.
Did you know immediately how you would respond? You were already drafting a statement that the world would soon read, but did you know that you weren't going to be one of the stand-by-your-man political wives, that you were going to go another way?
You know, much has been said of the fact that I didn't stand by him at his press conference, but remember, he was flying back into Atlanta.
You weren't there.
And then
right.
and driving to Columbia, and I was in Charleston.
Are you saying you would have if you had been there?
No, but in other words, it didn't even come up. If he had asked me, I would have said no. But no, I really had no interest in standing by him. The bigger question, the only concern on my plate really mm-hmm. was my family and my children. And I had been drafting the statement, as you point out, I was drafting a statement the day before when I knew he was on his way home. But I had no idea, frankly, what he was going to say when he came back and addressed the public or the waiting press.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with South Carolina First Lady Jenny Sanford about her husband, Governor Mark Sanford's very public affair, and her new book that tells the story. It's called Staying True. The whole world knew pieces of the story. Now they know a lot of it. On June 24th, 2009, at his infamous press conference, Governor Sanford explained how his affair had begun.
It began very innocently, as I suspect many of these things do, in just a casual email back and forth, in advice on one's life there and advice here. But here, recently, over this last year, it developed into something much more than that.
Emails back and forth that got pretty steamy and would become very public about, soulmates and tan lines. He apologized to a lot of people in that press conference upon his return from Argentina, including his family and the state.
I've let down a lot of people. That's the bottom line. And I let them down, and in every instance, I would ask their forgiveness. Forgiveness is not an immediate process. It is, in fact, a process that takes time, and I'll be in that process for quite some weeks and months, and I suspect years ahead.
Jenny Sanford tells the whole story in her new memoir, Staying True. She joins us from New York. Jenny Sanford, I wonder if you would read just a little bit for us from the book. You've got four wonderful sons. Your devotion to them is very clear throughout this book. You say that Mark Sanford, your husband, had become kind of distant from the boys and his fathering for a long time. But at one point, you had to sit down with your boys and tell them what was going on. You write movingly about it in the book, and I wondered if you would be good enough to read some of that.
I'd be happy to. When I sat the boys down, I explained to them that I had discovered in January that their dad was having an affair. Did they have sex? Asked Bolton. Yes, that's what an affair is about, I said. I told them they didn't know the woman, and they had nothing to do with causing the affair, nor could they have prevented it. It was not their fault. I also told them that I loved their dad and was hopeful that he would keep his word as he had looked me in the eyes and said, I will not see her, when he left. Mom, that would be a pretty big lie if he sees her, Blake said. Yes, I agreed, it would be a very big lie. I assured the boys that I would never leave them and that they shouldn't worry about a thing because I would work to provide whatever they might need in the future. I was a little teary when discussing this painful personal subject with them, but I also felt as if a weight had been lifted after I shared this secret with my precious sons. No child should have to learn such things, but I wanted them to be well prepared in case the story got out. I didn't want them to learn about Mark's affair from the television or the public. We prayed together for Mark, for the choices he would make. A few days later, when I had reason to believe Mark was with his lover, I decided to sit down with the boys again and to tell them her name was Belén Chapur and that she lived in Argentina. The children thought of the notes Mark had recently sent each of them. "That's it. His notes were goodbye," Blake said. I was crushed by the hurt they must have felt at learning of his betrayal, and also by their thinking he might abandon them. Then, with such clairvoyance, Bolton exclaimed, "Oh my gosh, this is going to be worse than Elliot Spitzer." "Yes," I thought, "unfortunately, it will be."
Oh my gosh. Jenny Sanford reading from her powerful new memoir, Staying True. And thank you for sharing that kind of moment. Lots of people go through this. You've brought it out for people to consider how you did it. And if we may, we've got a lot of people responding. If I may bring our listeners in from Myrtle Beach first, South Carolina. Patricia, you're on the air with the First Lady of South Carolina.
Thank you. What I went through when I heard him say, "my dear, dear friend," I felt disgusted and I wanted to vomit. My husband committed adultery against me also, and I knew that his beautiful wife, most likely her heart was in a million pieces, and I prayed right away that she would get a new heart and that this would not destroy her. And I'm still very upset about it to this day. And I admire her because I stayed in my marriage, I guess because I was a little bit of a coward. I admire her, and I think she's a very godly woman. Thank you.
Patricia, thank you.
Patricia, thank you so much, and thank you especially for those prayers.
Let's get one more right here. Sharon in Columbia, South Carolina. Sharon, you're on the air with Jenny Sanford.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Jenny, thank you for staying true and strong to your boys. Thank you. My question is what has helped you to remain focused and strong and able to come through this situation in the manner in which you've chosen?
You know, most of all, my faith. I have very strong faith, and sometimes things happen in life that shake your faith and they make you question a lot of things. It's an important time to go back to your faith, go back to the source, you know, fill your cup with love from the one that'll never disappoint, which is above. And then surround yourself with friends and family who love you. And, you know, it can get you through a lot of things. A glass of wine at night doesn't hurt.
It might help a little bit, too. Jenny Sanford, I wanted to ask you a bit more about faith and how that's worked for you. You were raised outside Chicago, quite Catholic, and kept your faith through all those years of marriage. Mark Sanford was also very publicly quite religious, lots of religious references. Even in his email correspondence with his with Belén Chapur in Argentina, he'd be quoting here. He's quoting in one of his emails, Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 13, of all things, you know, love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful, not arrogant or rude, rejoices in the right. How did you end up thinking about faith in the hands, in the mouth of this man who clearly wasn't following the very scriptures he was so often quoting?
You know, Tom, I married him because I believed he was a good person. One of the things that attracted me to him was his strong faith. But, you know, that's the nature of sin in this world. Everybody, you know, different times in their lives, every single day. There's not a day I don't sin in some way, shape, or form. But it's clear that he lost his grounding in faith, or he lost sight of his moral compass. And the real key now going forward for him and the challenge, and I hope he addresses it successfully and gets there, is can he reconnect his moral compass? Can he become grounded again in a solid tradition where he is doing right by our God? And, you know, I believe he can get there, but the choice has to be his, and he needs to do the work to make sure he gets there. It doesn't take away from my faith. It does, you know, it disappoints me.
Let me ask you, as someone who's been right in the middle of politics, you managed any number of his campaigns for Congress and for governor, and you've been right there with all the rest of us as we've come through a time recently, a decade or so, where lots of politicians put their faith right in the middle of their politics, really kind of worked that angle, though, you know, it may be quite sincere, but I wonder if this experience has made you a little more skeptical about political professions of faith.
No, not necessarily. I think that, you know, you know, I continue to be a positive person. I believe in Mark's goodness. Like I said, I hope he gets it back. There are politicians who I believe are, you know, hypocritical by nature, or that maybe talk about faith because that is a selling subject. At the same time, there are also politicians who don't talk about faith but talk about hot issues. Do you know what I mean? You know, mm-hmm. let's say it's the decade when you're supposed to talk about being tough on crime. So that's what they talk about. That's what politicians do sometimes is, you know, speak about certain subjects because they're hot. Those are the types of politicians that pay attention to the polls, and mm-hmm. they do what polls favorably. Mark was never really that kind of a politician. He never campaigned on his faith, but he wore it. He did speak about it openly. You know, as a wife who was with him for 20 years, I truly believed that was not something he was campaigning on. It was something that he believed in, and he clearly became lost. I would be wary of a politician who campaigns based on his faith. Mark, if you read the book, actually, mm-hmm. I go to very great lengths to say that, you know, and I remain proud of him. He campaigned on a set of fiscal conservative issues. He has consistently been about reducing debts and deficits and being very careful about how our governments spend the taxpayers' money. And he has stayed true to those. In the book, I also talk about how perhaps it was such strict adherence to those fiscal principles that caused him over time to lose sight of his values, which, in fact, I think matter more.
Left with quite a debt to you and the children. Maureen in Worcester, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Jenny Sanford.
Thank you, Tom. Jenny, I just wanted to thank you for being very refreshing and inspiring. As a woman, as a mother of 4 sons and 2 daughters, and as a human being, I have appreciated your honesty and your stand in this very public emotional time, and that you represented values of honesty and self-respect. And I have to say that I'm over 50, and it was a relief to see for the first time in my life that I recall seeing a woman, a public figure, make such a principled stand. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much, Maureen.
Thank you, Maureen. Did you feel like you were breaking ground in that? I mean, we had all watched what felt like an almost nonstop parade, Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Edwards and Zilda Spitzer and Suzanne Craig and in New Jersey, the governor's wife. We had seen an awful lot of women kind of humiliated at the side of powerful men. Did you feel like you were breaking new ground?
You know, the thought never crossed my mind. I was completely focused on the things that matter most, and it was really just my family. And you know, as you know, I did make a statement. It's very rare, I think, for spouses to put out statements. The statement was not a soundbite, though. It was a true reflection of what I believed was important at the time. And the statement talks about values. It talks about my faith. It talks about family. Mm-hmm. It talks about legacy. And it felt important at the time for me to put out something in a way that explained why I didn't know where he was and what I believed mattered then, and I continue to believe that matters.
You wrote, "We reached a point where I felt it was important to look my sons in the eyes and maintain my dignity, self-respect, and my basic sense of right and wrong. I therefore asked my husband to leave 2 weeks ago." And this was, of course, at the time of his first public admission of what had been going on. Charlotte, North Carolina. Stephen, you're on the air with Jenny Sanford.
So it's my understanding that he resigned, and we talk a little bit about how the other politicians that have extramarital affairs and why he wasn't impeached, go into a little bit about why he resigned, because they were all getting together to impeach him, you recall.
Yeah.
Remind us of where that all stands. He was censured for ridicule, bringing ridicule, dishonor, disgrace, and shame on the state. But what about the impeachment drive? Were you for it, and how did that all resolve?
You know, Stephen, thanks for your call. He actually did not resign. Mm-hmm. He is still governor. He did go through an impeachment process. They resolved it without impeaching him. He still has some ethics charges that they're in the process of resolving. You know, I'm not going to make any suggestion or give any opinion on whether he should resign or be impeached or not impeached. I really have continued and maintained steadfastly that the only thing I've been focusing on in this crisis is my family.
Let's go to Catherine in Charleston, South Carolina. Catherine, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. And Jenny, I just want to say how much
I admire you for being such a strong woman and such a strong person in the face of all this heartache and hardship. And, you know, what I think is really sad for women in your situation is that you can't just fall apart and be heartbroken and be sad. You have to be there for your sons, and I think you've just provided such a strong role model for them. My question to you would be, following all of this, I guess in following the last caller's question, that what do you say to your boys now that their dad is in such a public position and, you know, really not only made a huge error in judgment and broke all of your hearts in private, but did it very publicly, and that they, I'm sure, have to hear about this from their friends and will continue to do so. What do you say to them since he wasn't impeached and there was never really any, he didn't really get in trouble, quote unquote, for what he's done?
You know, one thing I've maintained to the boys, well, two thoughts come to my mind right now. One is I told them when he was away, one of the other conversations I had with the boys, I said, you know, if you put your faith in other people, and you should put your faith in other people, and you should learn to trust other people, but people will always disappoint. And the only father, in a way of speaking, the only real father that will never disappoint is your God. And so I said, number one, remember that. You know, your dad's going to disappoint you. I'm going to disappoint you. Your brothers are going to disappoint you. Your good friends are going to disappoint you. And, you know, that's life. So that's again, gets back to the importance of faith. With respect to his keeping his job, whatever, I mean, you know, he's still alive. He's got to move on in his life, too. And, you know, my hope and my sincere prayer for the sake of my children is that he reconnects with his moral compass and does show them. The most important thing Mark can do going forward is to show them a humble spirit of repentance, and that he can, in fact, rebuild his life and reconnect with what it means to have good character.
We can see how that would be critical for you and for your sons in particular. What about for the public, for voters considering Mark Sanford or other politicians in this situation? We've got a question here for you from online. Sam says, could you please ask Jenny if she thinks that voters should consider aspects of personal responsibility and character when evaluating candidates?
You know, I think they should. Now, that doesn't – there's a distinction, though, between, you know, aspects of character and integrity when you're voting. Those – that makes up a complete person, your stance on the issues combined with your character and your integrity, because that helps helps you guess when you go to the – or guess or judge when you're going to the voting booth how that person will deal in a crisis. Right. In Mark's case, I believed he was a man of integrity and had good character, as did many voters. That's why he won numerous elections. But all too often in our country, we demand perfection of our politicians. And to some extent, if somebody has made it to a certain age in life without having any mistakes that the world knows, you know, maybe we're demanding too much. In other words, there's a difference between somebody who has never sinned or has kind of, you know, almost a too perfect record, and somebody who maybe has sinned and made amends for those sins. So, again, you know, Mark Sanford has made some serious mistakes. You know, if he were ever to go on any ballot again, which I'm not so sure he ever will, but if he were ever to go on another ballot again, I think the burden is on him to significantly prove to the voters that, you know, to whatever voters on whatever election, that he had in fact, you know, made up for those sins and learned from them and had become a better character again. In other words, I don't think one sin should taint your record for your entire lifetime, but it certainly should be considered.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with South Carolina First Lady Jenny Sanford about her husband, Governor Mark Sanford's very public affair and her new book that tells the story. It's called Staying True. She joins us today from New York. Let's go to Mary in Boston. Mary, you're on the air with Jenny.
Hi, Jenny. It's so nice to hear your voice over the air. I'm a Jesuit educated woman like yourself. My sister was at Georgetown with you many years ago, Trish Figge, and I just wanted to tell you how much we think of you and love you and admire your poise and grace and spirituality and faith. You are one
Thanks,
great
Mary.
Lady.
Thanks, Mary. Hope you're doing well.
Thank you very much, Mary. Let's get another right here. Kimberly in Lafayette, Tennessee. Kimberly, you're on the air.
Hello. I was wondering how are you doing now, and how are your children holding up? Because such a public thing is very embarrassing. And I know about how you felt then a lot, but I was just, you know, you're a great inspiration, and I was just wondering how are you doing now? Are things much, you know, better now?
You know what? Kimberly, thank you. The boys are doing great. And in a funny way, I think we're all doing better because we're settled in at home. We have a direction. You know, a lot of the uncertainty is kind of behind us, and that actually helps us to move forward and to kind of press on. The boys, the summer was crazy with all that happened, and then I picked them up, moved out of the governor's mansion, and moved them back home and into a new school. And, you know, that brought with it its own challenges. But they've now made it through an entire semester, and they have new friends, and they're quite settled, and they're doing well scholastically. And our oldest son is applying to colleges. And, you know, each day that life becomes more normal is a better day. I might add, it's interesting. Mm. I did speak a lot in the book about how isolating a political job can become and how disconnected the politician can become. Mm-hmm. But to some extent, you forget that the family becomes a little bit disconnected from reality, too. And living in a governor's mansion complex, you know, mm-hmm. I used to refer to it as the gated community of one,
right.
Because it was, you know, 9 acres that's gated and, you know, surrounded by guards and security cameras. And you're there all by yourselves. They're, you know, the kids, you remember, we have 4 children. They didn't really, mm-hmm. they didn't play with friends in the neighborhood, freely come and go like they can do now. So they're slowly getting actually much more acclimated into, you know, more normal life. You know, little things, they're learning how to answer the telephone at home, which they didn't do because the security
somebody else
guard
would
did.
Do it, right?
Right. Little things like that. It's amazing how, you know, just getting back into normal life, it's actually there are lots of little daily joys.
Out of the pressure cooker. You know, our caller Mary talked about your time at Georgetown, and I wanted to go back. You've got some interesting stories in the book about your early life and early life with Mark Sanford that have led, you know, a lot of readers to say, wait a minute, didn't you see something was kind of off even back then? I mean, you're clearly telling us that you've thought back through those early days in what you're recounting here. For example, when you were a vice president with Lazard Frere in New York, kind of a big mergers and acquisition work, savvy gal, and you meet this guy and you go down to visit him and his family for the first time in South Carolina, and I was stunned by how he expected you to do that. Could you tell us that story?
Oh, he left a car for me at the airport, and it was a New Year's Eve. It was, and I think the weather was pretty bad, and he left his car at the airport, and you know. Truth be told, I had been in his car before, and it just didn't occur to me. I just completely was lost on me that it was a stick shift, and I don't drive stick.
And the family farm was 50 miles or so from the airport.
50 miles down these country roads, and the fog was, you know, there was kind of this mist on the road, and I had driven a stick shift truck once way back when in the back roads of northern Wisconsin
once.
With my friend Julie Joyce Canary, and right. So I tried to remember what it was you were supposed to do with those the extra pedal and with the gear, and I probably did some real damage to his car, frankly, because I never went into the fourth gear. But
you're
but
telling
I made
us this story. I mean, you're going through the fog. You're having to call and figure out. He's not out looking for you. You're kind of telling us this story
right.
to say maybe I should have wondered about this. This wasn't the
right.
most thoughtful welcome to South Carolina.
Right. Now, you know, he's a quirky guy. And but to some extent, I don't know, maybe I was attracted to the quirkiness. But mm-hmm. I will say that once I got there to where I met him that night on New Year's Eve, I actually met him at a party.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a little bit cold then. But then, and the rest of the weekend, I got to know him in a completely different way. And that was really the beginning of my real attraction to him, because at that weekend we had just been on a couple of, you know, very benign dates. But that weekend, you know, he opened up in a very different manner after that original drive, that harrowing drive.
Yeah.
And he was quite sweet and quite genuine. And I learned some other things about him that weekend, about how he saved the family farm and mm-hmm. the tough time he had when his dad died, at a fairly young age. And those kinds of things, you know, showed a different side of him.
You got ready to marry him, and he sent you a kind of phony prenuptial agreement.
But it wasn't so clear to you when you began reading it whether it was a joke or not. And even as a joke, some of the stuff in it is really eyebrow-raising. That, you know, you agree that wife agrees to limit her expenditures for all her personal items and usages to clothes, pantyhose, makeup, jewelry, perfume, automobiles, entertainment, medical bills, medicine to $100 a month. And then it says, in deference to husband's gender-related superior intellect and judgment, yeah, wife hereby agrees that husband will be the final arbiter in all matters. Ha ha.
Yeah.
Ruth Marcus at the Washington Post read that and said, red alert, red alert, awooga, wooga, you know, don't do this.
Yeah. No, but I thought it was kind of clever because the document looked incredibly legal and it was kind of messengered over to my office. And I thought, how dare he bring me a prenuptial when we hadn't even discussed this? But then when I read it, it was so outlandish. And there were some other parts in there that were more outlandish that I didn't print. But I mean, it was clearly a joke. So I thought it was, you know, we kind of pulled the wool over my eyes because I was so hot under the collar when I first read it. But it was a joke. Having said that, it had a clause in there that said wife agrees to bear only male children. And then I ended up having only males. I mean, go figure.
He gave you kind of a necklace and then took it back. Why?
He did. As a matter of fact, you guys can't see me right now because I'm in a radio studio and I'm, yes, I'm wearing a necklace and some pretty earrings he actually gave me that he didn't take back. So there were times he did nice things, but this one time he had forgotten my birthday one year. And so the next year he decided to do something nice for me and he was in Congress in D.C. Mm-hmm. and I was home with the babies and he had somebody in his office or a friend buy me a necklace that had a little diamond on it and had it delivered to the house somewhere and hidden. And then he faxed to the campaign office in the house, in the basement. He faxed clues, and he sent the boys and I on a little scavenger hunt, which had just, you know, a darling note on it. And, mm-hmm, you know, I thought it was very sweet and very clever, and it took us a while to find the silly necklace, and we found the necklace, and I was like, oh, I just thought it was wonderful. And I put it on, and, of course, remember, he ordered this over the phone. So mm-hmm, he arrived a few days later, and we already had guests over, and he walked in the house, and I was wearing the necklace, and he saw it, and his eyes popped out, and he immediately said, oh, that's what I spent all that money on. I hope you kept the box. And then he took it back the next day. And, you know, I guess he must have been expecting that I would be wearing the Hope diamond on my neck, around my neck. And he was quite disappointed. But that gets to the essence of who he is. He's an incredibly frugal guy. And, you know, by that time in our marriage, I totally understood that. So, you know, I was disappointed he took the necklace back. But, you know, it in no way did it rock me because, you know, I thought actually the sheer act of the scavenger hunt was quite clever.
The prenup was maybe a joke. But in your actual wedding vows, the vows you used to marry Mark Sanford, you were picking readings, and he told you he did not want to use a wedding vow that included the promise to be faithful. That right. turned out to be a little bit of a problem. What did you make of it at the time?
Yes, and in hindsight, you know, maybe I should have paid more attention. But, you know, I think knowing what I knew then, I would have made the same decision. The way he brought it up, you know, your priest gives you, or, you know, there's a book and there's a number of different vows. And he said, you know, with all due respect, I don't want to use one of these that uses the word faithful. But remember, this is a guy who also had already told me, written down, that he wants to live by a Bible verse that includes the word faithful in it. So, there, you know, clearly there's an inconsistency there. But it was the beginning of a very honest and open discussion. You know, I started this way. I said, you know, Mark, with all due respect, if you don't want to be faithful, we shouldn't get married. I mean, I'm not getting married to somebody who has no intent to be faithful. I said, but marriage is a vow of fidelity and faithfulness, regardless of the words that you choose. I don't care what words you choose. It is a vow of faithfulness and fidelity. And if you aren't making that vow to me now or in the sheer act of getting married, then we shouldn't be marrying. So, you know, he wholeheartedly agreed and was very clear to me that this was just in some reason he had some kind of back of his mind doubt about his ability to remain true. Now, you know, we all have doubts when we marry. And I had doubts about him. I did have lots of doubts about him. But that was the least of my worries. Knowing this guy, he was clumsy with women. He, you know, he's a quirky guy, but women were not his strong point. And so I honestly and earnestly believed he would be able to be faithful. I took the discussion as a very honest discussion, and my doubts really were elsewhere.
As a wife, as a woman, as a human being, can you help us understand his very sort of teary professions of love for the other woman, for Belén Chapur, the Argentine woman, in very public settings, you know, talking about her as soulmate and so on? What was going on there? Had did you feel that something had been long lost between the two of you? Had he been alone? Were you sympathetic at all to that, or did that just strike you as galling? You, at one point, you in tough conversations with him, I guess you called her a whore, and she said she is not a whore. He said, what do you make of that relationship and why it developed and what was going on with his public professions of love for a woman, not his wife?
You know, I think, it'll be a long time before I can really put my finger on, you know, everything that happened or what drove him really to do this. And maybe in time he'll marry her. I have no idea. It had become clear to me even before that press conference, though, that he obviously had feelings for this woman. And that was very difficult to take. I do talk at great length in the book about not only how disconnected he came from, he became in the political world from his core values and from the way normal people live, you know, the consequences of your actions and the way normal people have to deal with daily life, because so many things were done for him, if you will. And and because he's also you're constantly creating an image and you live in kind of a soundbite generation instead of a real interactive world like most other normal people do. Mm-hmm. So he had become disconnected. Part of that disconnection that happens with our politicians, at the same time, Mark was standing alone in the stimulus battle. He was fighting some lonely battles in his job. I think his job itself is a fairly lonely job. So, you know, on the one hand, I had empathized in the marriage, and particularly in his time as governor, about the loneliness of the position. Mm. But my empathy can only go so far. In other words, I wasn't able to solve what ailed him. And you know, it's clear now that I guess I didn't satisfy as a wife such that he had to go elsewhere. But at the end of the day, I don't know, you know, time will tell whether he really, you know, is in love with this other woman or whether it was just a fantasy and an escape from the life that he was in.
I can't tell listening between the lines there. Are you still open to getting back together with Governor Sanford?
No.
You will be divorced this month?
Either at the end of this month or beginning of next month, yes.
Yasha, in Imnaha, Oregon, you're on the air with Jenny Sanford.
Thank you. I'm sorry to say that it sounds to me as though Mrs. Sanford continues to excuse Mark Sanford's behavior. What I see is that, like most of the overpaid clerks that we've sent to Washington and called senators and representatives, Mark Sanford considered himself a rock star above the moral concerns of the general public. Following this story and listening to him many times on the radio, he has made excuses for himself. He considers himself a rock star, and the normal laws and rules of society don't apply to him. And this is a tendency that I've remarked for many of our senators.
Yasha, let us pick it up. Our time is short here. Jenny Sanford, what do you say to Yasha's observation?
Yeah, Yasha, I respect your opinion, but I don't believe I am excusing his behavior, actually. I am trying to empathize and understand what got him so disconnected, but in no way am I excusing his behavior or condoning it in any way, shape, or form. As a matter of fact, I think that's why I'm moving on. But you're right. You do point out, as I describe in this book, sometimes some of these politicians become so, again, I use the word disconnected from the way other people live and the consequences that come along with actions and choices. So I agree with you that you know, his behavior was inexcusable.
You have an interesting meditation near the end of the book on forgiveness and what it means, what it's come to mean for you. I wonder if the governor has asked for your forgiveness, whether he has or not. Have you fully given it, whatever that means? Well, what does that mean? And is it for him or for yourself?
You know, I think forgiveness is freeing both for the forgiver or for the forgiver and the one that's being forgiven. I have forgiven him, but reconciliation is very different. And I have a discussion now with my kids on almost a regular basis, because as we get closer to actually having the divorce be made final, they don't want me to divorce. You know, all kids just really want their parents to stay together. Mm. And they'll say to me, "But Mom, we don't understand. If you've forgiven him, why aren't you staying married? Hmm. And, you know, they are two different things. But I can't be the ultimate judge of his behavior because I haven't walked fully in his shoes. I don't know everything going on in his mind. You know, God is the one he really needs to make peace with and with himself. And as I've said before, he needs to the true measure of when he's refound himself will be shown in his actions over a long period of time. But for me to move on happily and freely and for me to give him the right to move on happily and freely, forgiveness is essential.
We've just got a few seconds. What's your future? Back to banking? Back to the beach?
I'm going back
politics?
To the beach to raise my kids. I'm going back to the beach to raise my kids, hug them and love them and hope that they can grow into be men of character. And work someday, but not yet.
Jenny Sanford, her new memoir is Staying True. We appreciate your example in all this, and we appreciate your time with us today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
First Lady of South Carolina, at least for a few weeks more. Her book is Staying True. She joined us from New York. That's Jenny Sanford. Listeners, thank you very much for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, or follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point Radio.